Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. Today we're happy because we have with us two women who have wanted to share their Mormon stories with us. We have Jamie and we have Sarah, and we'll begin with Sarah and let her just take over voices for us today.
Awesome. So one of the things that we had wanted to talk about, I think a little, was our experience as single women in the church. Both of us were single for most or all of our 20s. And I think in order to understand that experience, and I think it's something that a lot of other women can probably relate to, it would help to talk a little bit about the narrative that was given to us for like life as a Mormon woman and what that looks like and what you need to prepare for from a young age. I don't know. So Jamie, do you want to talk a little bit about?
Yeah, I do. Cause I think that's a really important point that you bring up, Sarah, is we hear it a lot in other forums. I mean, it's being discussed right now that, especially with the ordained women movement, that, you know, women are conditioned to be wives and mothers. That is your role. It's, you know, packaged so that it's a divine purpose. And who doesn't want to be a part of something so special? It's like this privilege. Like, you get to be a wife and a mother. And I'm not a wife or a mother. And I imagine that the realities are probably a lot different than the way it's portrayed in the church, but,
like a fairy tale.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm just thinking of my own growing up experience, you know, my mom cleaning up throw up in the middle of the night or whatever. Those are not glamorous motherhood moments, I'm sure. But still, I think when you're raised from a young age to think that that's what you need to be and that's who you are and that's your potential, then that's what you seek after.
It changes the decisions that you make.
Absolutely.
Or it dictates the decisions that you make.
Yeah. Yeah, because women in the church aren't, you know, we don't tell young women, you can do anything you want for a career.
Well, so when you were growing up, when did you notice it starting to think about career? Because, I mean, I'll talk for me. I remember in elementary school, our teachers would ask, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And throughout elementary school, it was always, I want to be a teacher or an author. My mom had been an elementary teacher before she had kids, and I liked my teachers, and I liked books. And so those were kind of two options that seemed really exciting to me as a kid. But at some point, that got modified during Young Women's, I believe, where it was like, well, sure, I enjoy doing different things, but what I want to be is a stay-at-home mom. Like, and that became, at least by the end of high school, that was my new, like, this is what I want to be when I grow up. I think partly because that's how I interpreted the messages that I got about my divine mission and purpose and my identity as a woman was...
Like, at that time, were you happy to have that as your purpose in life?
Oh yeah, because I loved those messages in Young Women talking about like how glorious it is to be a wife and mother. And to be honest, I think there's a truth in that. I don't think it is necessarily religious truth, but I think it's very fulfilling to have a family. I imagine I don't have kids yet, but when you package in and it's divine. And it's the most unselfish thing you can do.
Well, and it's all you are. That's where I have the problem with the rhetoric and the way, you know, we speak about women's roles in the church. I don't think there's anything wrong with being a wife and a mother. And in fact, I would still like to pursue those goals in the future because I do think that there is sort of a natural, you know, people want to marry and have families, and that's just normal for many.
A lot of people.
So I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I think that there's something very limiting with
when it's it's a mutually exclusive choice. It's
yes.
Like you either choose to be this mother and give everything to it, or it's not your top priority because you're choosing something else and that's going to push it out or like diminish how well you're able to achieve that or
yes, it's
that.
Portrayed so black and white. It's like you've got your stay-at-home moms and then you've got your working moms. And I'm not a part of that culture, but I do have a friend who is, and she said there is still tension between those two groups, even now in her church situation. And that's very interesting to me. I think it's changing.
I think it's changing.
It's changing a lot.
But when I was a young woman in the 90s, it was still very much presented as the ideal, I felt like.
And I think it still is. I think it is still presented as the ideal. The problem also is that then we're not training or we're not helping young women recognize that, okay, well, the statistical problem that we have in the church right now is that there are way more women than men, single women than men. So automatically, not all women in the church are going to find a Mormon man to marry. And I know that's what we're going to get into a little bit later, but I just think, you know, when we say to somebody, this is your role, this is your only role, and then that doesn't happen, women don't know what to do.
And when you were a young woman, did you ever consider an option that you wouldn't fulfill that role as mother and wife as soon as you had expected?
I did not question it.
Yeah, neither did I. And I remember a single woman came to our ward and she had to be like 50 years old, I think. And it was seriously looked to her like she was an alien.
Mm-hmm.
And even the rhetoric that was going around was like, she's going to be our Sunday school teacher, but she's not married.
It was an important part
of her
future, of her teaching.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, The marital status is so important in the church, and it's unfortunate, but single women have the lowest status in the church because you need a man to be anything. And even then, you're still not, obviously, you know, with the ordained women movement.
Quite equal.
You're not at all. It's still a very patriarchal, rigid structure, but at least if you have a husband, that gives you some level of
completeness.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I think from my teens, this became clear that this was my path. This was my focus. And it's not like it came out of nowhere. I mean, from a very young age, I knew that I didn't have a middle name so that when I got married, my last name would be a middle name, even though the boys in our family had middle names. You know, so like even with like how I was named, like this was like communicated from a young age and it crystallized and I got it by the time I was a teenager. And at the same time, education was really important in my family. And so there was no question about whether or not I was going to get a college degree, but I knew that I was only getting a college degree just in case, like in 20 years, my husband died and I would need to have something to fall back on. And also to,
plan.
You know, to be educated in general seemed like a desirable thing, which I still feel that way. but there was never this, I never really expected that I would need to work as more than a backup plan. And it changed, I mean, and it influenced what degree I majored in, because I was thinking my degree needs to prepare me for a career that would be useful as a backup plan and also, in the meantime, that will be useful in preparing me to be a better mom, because that will be my job.
What was your life plan at, like, say, age 18? What did you see your events?
So I remember, actually, my high school English teacher asking our class, like, when we thought we would get married, and I said 21. So I imagined that I would go to college, I would get married at 21, I would graduate, and then I would start having kids. And actually, when I was in college, I changed my major during the first year of college from like home ec to nutrition. And by changing it, I had to add extra classes. And I remember like feeling this sense of panic, like I need to get through these classes as fast as possible because I could get married at any point and I need to be ready to focus on my family. And I don't want to have 2 years of school hanging over my head. I remember like literally like making plans and thinking about this, like it could happen at any moment. In order to be prepared, I have to like pound through my classes and like graduate ASAP.
That's really interesting. So my experience is a little bit different than that. I absolutely expected to get married by, you know, 22, 23, but I did fight it a little bit. I remember having a conversation with my dad when I was a teenager, and I said, what if I don't want to get married and have kids? What if that's not something I desire? And he said, you would never be happy being alone, which is funny because he's partly right. I mean, I've been alone for a long time, and ultimately that's why I left the church, because I could see that I was going to continue to be alone for probably the rest of my life, and I don't want that. However, it's interesting to me that I was thinking about it even a little bit back then when I was a teenager, because I still realized that there was something in me that's like, okay, but what are my dreams and desires and wishes? And I did not choose a practical major, but I didn't choose one that I thought would be practical for a family or for a career. I just kind of majored in what I wanted. And, you know, and I've been fine, But I also come from a family that really values education, so it was never a question of going to college, and I find that I really thrive in an academic environment. Like, I love school, I love those kinds of discussions, I love learning to think critically, and it's interesting to me that that started coming out when I was a teenager, but I still didn't expect my path to like deviate different from the traditional. I mean, I fully expected that I would be married by now.
You felt comfortable following kind of your own inclinations while still expecting a certain kind of path to be fulfilled.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of the problem, and hopefully this isn't too much of a tangent, but I think that Mormonism can lead to extreme passiveness. So I honestly, it didn't occur to me that I would need to like put all this effort into any one thing in my life, because I really thought, well, God's just going to provide me somebody to marry. And really, that's the way it seemed to happen for most of my friends. They met somebody at school or work or through a mutual friend or whatever, and then it just worked. And so it didn't even occur to me that I would have to like try for something.
Be too active about.
Yeah. And of course now I look back on that and think that's ridiculous, and how many opportunities I missed because I was just kind of thinking, well, if it's supposed to work out, it'll just work out. And, you know, I'm still sort of grieving some of those lost years because that was my attitude then, but fortunately I know better now, at least. But yeah, it never even occurred to me that it might be different, and that I would need to like take action if I wanted things to go a certain way.
So I don't know if this is skipping ahead, but when did you start to think that it might not happen the way you expected it to, that your life might not take the course you expected it to?
I think it was probably around 26 or 27 for me. That's where I really began to feel disconnected from myself, from my peers. I started withdrawing from others around that time. And what I, you know, looking back, of course, it's clear to me that I was slipping into a depression. But I had, you know, I had all these promises and these blessings about this great family that I was going to raise. And I was excited to do that. I wanted to be a mom. And then I thought, okay, but I'm not dating and I'm in a singles ward where the women outnumber the men significantly.
And that's already in like your mid-20s.
And that's in my mid-20s. So what I did when I was about 25 or 26 was I just decided, well, it's just not going to happen, but I'm not going to let it bug me. And I started I started suppressing my emotions, my sexual needs, everything right at about that time. I was like, I'm not going to deal with it, and I'm just going to go on with life. And then by the time I was 28, 29, that led to pretty severe depression, and that's where my faith crisis really, really began.
And what about you, Sarah? When did you start realizing the disconnect?
Well, so I actually started fearing that my life was not going to go as expected while I was still in college. My patriarchal blessing had actually been quite vague, and it really didn't say anything about kids. And so I remember talking to one of my roommates and being like, what if that means I'm not going to get married? And she was like, you're going to get married. But I went through college and my roommates and close friends all kind of got married off. And then I remember I was kind of in denial until my senior year of high school. Keep in mind, senior year of college. At this time, I'm 21. And I start like going into full on panic mode. Like, well, I wouldn't have used this word, but oh shit. Like, I wasn't planning for being single beyond the point of graduation, and here I am. It's unrealistic that in the next 6 months I'm going to meet someone and get married and I'm going to graduate. And I started kind of freaking out. And I remember it became a constant prayer, Please help me to prepare to be a wife and mother, and please help me to find that opportunity to become a wife and mother. And it was on my mind all the time from age 21, basically. And in all of the decisions I made after that point in my life, my underlying question was, what do I need to do, like God, in order to get to the place where you introduce me to my husband and he saves me from this like limbo that I kind of felt like I was in.
Well, and a very undesirable life, because the single life is not respected in the church.
And yeah, and I don't think there's like meta awareness about that, but it's the reality that, yeah. And as a woman, I think in particular, this idea of like continuing on and not having marriage prospects, it's very undesirable. The next several years, I found work, because what do? You graduate, you're single, you find a job. I found jobs. I went on a mission. I mean, yeah, I would say from 21, that was like constantly what I was thinking about and worrying that it wasn't going to work out for me. And all of my experiences seemed to reinforce that fear. I rarely dated.
And I just want to insert here that Sarah and I are horribly unattractive, and that's why we didn't get married.
Yeah, we have
I guess we could probably just end the conversation right now. We each weigh like 10,000 pounds and are practically disfigured.
Well, I do have to say, like, that was how I spent much of my 20s, is wondering what it was about me that was preventing me from getting married.
And, oh, me too.
I mean, even in college, someone very close to me, a family member, recommended that maybe I take a semester off to lose 10 pounds, you know, because maybe that's why I wasn't dating. And it was just kind of like, oh, maybe I'm way too much. Maybe I'm too smart. You know, like,
I had a mission companion tell me that I am too sarcastic for the boys in Utah. So if I ever planned on getting married, I needed to move out of state where they could handle my level of sarcasm.
You're too much woman for these Mormon boys, huh?
I guess so.
I do want to say I'm looking at both of them. They're both very attractive, so I know that's not why they're single. But I do want to ask if that influenced their missions to go on missions, that they were single. I know that it's not so much now, but at least when I was younger, that ones that couldn't get married or the ones that weren't quite as attractive would find themselves on missions, because what else are they going to do? So that influenced your decision?
So I think it's, I think I can mention that I was engaged while I was at BYU, and it was not a healthy, good relationship. And it did scare me off of dating for a little while, which I don't blame that on the church at all. That was just, you know, cause, effect. I wasn't able as a, you know, 21-year-old to put those two together to make that connection. But I was a little afraid of dating. So for me, going on a mission was a reprieve from what had been a really terrible experience. And it actually, a lot of healing did come from my mission. And I think it's because I was, you know, had removed myself from a toxic, an environment that had become toxic for me. And so I have good thoughts about my mission, even though I went to this mission of like ultra strict rules. And, you know, there were many nightmarish things about it, which is, I think, every mission.
For me, I guess we've had pretty different experiences in some ways, because for me, I would say being single was very much a part of why I went on a mission, but it wasn't necessarily like, I don't know what to do with myself. Although really that was probably true, but consciously I wasn't thinking of it that way, but I felt like God was testing me by me still being single. And that going on a mission was a way to show him that I was willing to submit my will or sacrifice my will and what I wanted, which was marriage and family, in order to serve him, to kind of like prove my loyalty, my devotion, my faith.
I'm really glad you bring that up, Sarah, because that's still how it's talked about. And it's the same with being homosexual. It's still talked about like, we're really sorry that you have this struggle, but God is testing you. And I remember when I was 26 or 27, I went to a fireside that had Kristen Oakes as the speaker. And, you know, she was single many, many years before she married Dallin H. Oakes. And she kept reinforcing the idea that you are living plan A. This is what God wants for you. He has like created this plan for you and you are following it. So she's
As a single person.
As a single person. Yeah. And I remember sitting there, thinking, I don't believe that. I don't believe it. It's just, it's too painful. So I don't believe it. And I remember walking home with my roommates and, you know, I probably was being sarcastic about it at that point, but I just remember saying that's not true. That doesn't feel true to me, that this is like the plan for me and I have no choice but to follow it. Like God segments out who he wants to be gay, who he wants to be married, who he wants to be single. And they all have their own set of challenges and you're just supposed to deal with it. I couldn't accept that. I'm like, no, I'm single because I haven't met anyone. That's why I'm single. And it's now more difficult to meet people. And the, you know, likelihood of me getting married is less and less because I'm competing against like 400 girls for, you know, 50 guys. That's why I'm single. To me, it was more of a math problem than a divine plan.
Well, and I think like the older I got, that's how it seemed to me as well. So I mean, I kept myself busy. I didn't come back from my mission until I was 25. And then again, you know, the constant prayer. Okay. Now what? I've served my mission. I have my degree. Now what do I need to do to find, you know, to prove that I'm ready to be married? And I started feeling like the guys in my singles wards were the leftovers, if that makes sense. I kind of started feeling like it was hard to find one that I was really interested in. And I don't mean to sound like I think I'm so great.
You are great though.
but like I had an even harder time connecting with guys in my ward once I got to be 25, 26, 27. And they weren't interested in me and I wasn't interested in them. And it started to be really scary to me. This like math problem, because I could see where this was going with dwindling numbers on the guy's side and like an overabundance of like kind, good, beautiful, intelligent women.
We could bring up polygamy right now. Wouldn't it work well?
Right? No, but I had that same experience, Sarah. And I remember, so I think what happens to a lot of older singles is they look around and there are singles wards, and, you know, it usually is about 5% of the girls who do about 90% of the dating. And there aren't enough guys to go around.
And it's probably a limited number of the guys who do a lot of the dating as well.
I think so too. And I think we should talk about the pressures that are put on the guys.
Oh yeah.
Because I think that, you know, although we're speaking to the single woman experience, that's what we're familiar with. I imagine it has to be difficult for the single men as well, because they're being shamed and berated at every conference
and
every state conference.
At church.
At church.
And in interviews with their bishops.
And the girls are bitter and angry, and why aren't you asking me out? Like, because you're scary. That might be a reason, you know, but so what's happening is this dating culture is becoming more and more toxic the older you get,
yeah.
Because the women say, all the men are closeted gays, socially inadequate,
addicted
they can't
to
get
porn.
A job. Yeah, get addicted to porn, can't get a job. And all the men are saying, like, well, the women are pushy, or they're unattractive, or they're overweight, or whatever. And like, we're blaming the sexes instead of looking at what the real problem is, which to me is just what I've stated multiple times. There just aren't enough Mormon men for Mormon women. That's all it is. And
well, and I do think it is more than a numbers game. Because I do think from an early age, there are the beginnings of this pitting the sexes against each other.
Yeah, that's true.
And I guess I'll qualify
that's a good
that.
Point.
I do feel like from a young age, and this has been talked about a lot in the Blogger Knackle, right, or whatever, is that there is so much attention on the male experience, and the women experience is seen as being supportive of that male experience from a very young age. And what happens is that the men become kind of like the center of the focus. And I think that that is actually hurtful and damaging to men in the church, because I feel like they don't see that that's a problem. To think that it's okay for life to revolve all around me. Like, my job that's going to dictate the course of life for my family, and my wife is there to support me. And I feel, I don't know if what I'm saying is clear.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that, Sarah. And I'm glad you brought that up. That's a really good point. I think that's true. And I do think there's a level of entitlement that
right.
some of these men feel, not all, but some, because they have been raised to think, like, you are special, like, you get to pass the sacrament. You're going to go on a mission.
And
if you're
righteous enough, you're going to have a beautiful,
yeah,
submissive wife.
Exactly. And it's...
And no sarcasm allowed.
Or no intelligent
But
thoughts.
I really, on my mission president really was one of those that stood up and said, the more doors you knock, elders, the prettier your wife is going to be. And I will be honest, I looked around at some of those homely elders and I thought, really, president? Are you sure you should be making these kinds of promises? But
he really said that.
He really said that. He really said that. And it was funny because so the sisters would always sit on the front row. And whenever he said that, he would never ever make eye contact with me. And he probably knew that I was completely glaring at him when he said that, because I think it's a terrible thing to say. And
as, especially as a spiritual leader, I mean,
yeah,
he's teaching it almost as if like, this is a spiritual truth. Like, you work hard, your wife is your reward.
Yeah, exactly. So I think you are right that, the problems aren't just numbers. A woman is a man's prize. And even, you know, we even see it, I hope I can bring this up, but we even see it in the temple, like Eve doesn't even get to, like, you know, they don't say, Eve, what would you like to be named? Do do you like the name Eve? This is what it means. Are you okay with this? It's like they choose everything
she's like
for
Adam's
her.
Pet.
Yeah. And help. Yeah. And
help
she's,
me.
Yeah. She's just like, oh, well, I was created for you, Adam. That's why I'm here.
The first time I went to the temple, and I remember they were saying that the only way a woman can get to the temple is with her husband, through her husband. And I just thinking, oh, well, thank goodness I'm married.
Yeah.
I can't imagine as a single woman. Well, I guess I'll never get to heaven.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was always on my mind, right? Like that.
Oh yeah. Because the doctrine excludes single people.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and I just need to say this, like, telling people that they can get married in the next life is not comforting.
Oh my gosh.
Like, in the slightest. In fact, it's insulting. Like, this life doesn't really matter at all. That's like basically what it's saying. It's dismissing it. And to me, it's just a total cop out. And it's another thing that kind of launched my faith crisis in my late 20s was I realized, okay, so I'm basically waiting to die to have what I want. And that's, sadly, that's really how I felt.
Right. It was like an endurance test.
Yeah.
Until you can get your prize, and apparently it's not in this life.
Yeah, like, sorry, you weren't picked. But maybe if you're good, you'll be selected in the next life. Or, as a happy alternative, you can be a ministering angel. There's that sarcasm again.
Well, and I want to talk a little more too, like, going back to something you said about the entitlement that, men feel in the church. And I think that part of the reason why they feel so entitled is because of so much pressure put on them to lead their families, to provide for their families, to save their families, to lead the church. And, I do think that's a lot of responsibility. And I feel like, that's part of why there's gotta be a reward to come along with that. And that's, you know, testimony Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
Who's gonna be like the supporting actress in my story where I have to do all these hard things for the Lord.
No, I think you're exactly right. And I think, you know, we've talked a little bit about this before, and something you mentioned that was an excellent point was because of that pressure that we put on the men, they don't feel like they can be vulnerable.
Right. And the problem with not being vulnerable when you're trying to connect with someone romantically is that I don't feel like you have as deep a connection when one of you has to have this permanent mask of I'm strong and I'm the leader and I'm here to take care of you. And women are allowed to be vulnerable, but I think sometimes it's almost exhausting to some of the men, the Mormon men I know. Their wives exhaust them, and I think partly it's because those men are not allowed to, like, take down that mask and just be real.
And, I think you're right.
Imperfect and equal to their spouses. Random thoughts.
No, I think you're exactly right about that.
So there's, like, difficulty connecting, I think, as the older you get, the worse the odds are, because men are like bleeding, hemorrhaging out of the church, and many women are staying because they believe in that happily ever after story.
Yeah. And, but they're staying. And I do know that there are some women, some single women who are very offended by, like, if somebody assumes that they're sad about their single status. However, The majority that I know are deeply sad. And yes, they have good careers and they have friends and they have hobbies and interests and, you know, they're doing all of these good things, but they're deeply, deeply sad. And I was deeply sad. I was burying it and I was pretending that I wasn't sad, but the reality was that I was so sad that I kept thinking, so how long do I have to endure? If, like, death is my only out, like, can we speed it up at all? And I mean, I hate to admit that,
but it's just the reality.
But I was just that sad about it. And, you know, I think we should each talk about our breaking points. What was your breaking point, Sarah?
When I was 27-ish. Well, basically, I had, you know, I was very depressed basically from my mission. And I think part of that, again, is because I started to feel like reality is God doesn't want for me what I want for myself. Like, cause I want this dream that all my leaders promised me would be wonderful of being a wife and mother, but apparently God doesn't want that for me. And so from my mission, I started to become increasingly depressed with this reality of me not wanting the right things, apparently, and God wanting things that weren't happy. But I tried to keep myself busy, and I want to say, yeah, when I was around 27, I started to feel like life in a singles ward was really petty. I felt like the girls were catty, and I felt like myself. I felt myself becoming bitter and becoming catty and angry, and I didn't like that person. I didn't like feeling that way, and I didn't like that bitterness that like permeated my life. And meanwhile, I started grad school, and I do think that starting grad school was huge for me because I took a class on the psychology of learning, and we learned about various theories of learning, and one I learned, it was really my first formal exposure to the idea of behaviorism. And in modern education, behaviorism is not perceived as a very progressive or ideal approach to learning, where you reward good behavior and punish bad behavior, for example. It's seen as somewhat manipulative and not necessarily as effective in achieving deep and meaningful learning. And it was really interesting to me because I was like, that's strange, because the whole gospel, I guess, framework is behaviorist. God is a behaviorist. He rewards the righteous. He punishes the wicked. And maybe not.
Except if you look around, it doesn't even make any sense because the reality doesn't line up with that. But that's true. That's exactly how it's taught.
Well, and you're taught, well, and if it's not immediate, it is immediate in terms of the spirit leaving.
That's true.
Right? The wicked versus
there's always some sort of excuse.
There's some explanation. And I started to wonder, like, why, if the gospel is true, why is it using such a primitive, why would God use such a primitive educational approach for his children? Why wouldn't he use a more constructivist approach where his children are empowered to like make sense of their experiences? And I'm don't want to get too philosophical, but it really started like my breaking point. And then meanwhile, I had kind of a falling out with some of my close friends over limited dating resources in our singles ward, which was very painful. And so I changed singles wards. This is December of like 2008, I want to say. And I changed singles wards and I started attending a new singles ward, but that bitterness continued to like permeate like my life and my experience at church, and I hated it. And I was like, why can't I just feel good? I want to feel peace. I want to feel love. I want to feel edified. But I just felt angry at empty promises. I felt like that people who got married young were making over the pulpit, like the bishoprics in these singles wards. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to Relief Society one of my last times in this particular singles ward, and this is going to seem really random that this was like one of the straws on the camel's back, but the woman in Relief Society who was conducting was announcing an activity, and we were going to be watching a movie for a Relief Society activity. And she said, I want to apologize because some people were offended by the PG-13 movie that we watched last time. And so this movie for this next activity is PG. And I remember like my mind rebelling. Like I remember hearing that and thinking, are you kidding me? I'm going to this place where I want to be nourished. I want to be healed. I want to feel happy. I want to feel hope. And we're focusing on like language or maybe the depiction of like violence or sex or something being offensive. And I'm like, life, there are bigger problems out there. Being single, like, is a big problem, but people starving is a big problem. Poverty is a big problem. There are all these things that are big problems. Like saying the word fuck is not a big problem, you know, like, or hearing it. And I'm pretty sure I went to church for one more week after that. And I again felt angry in sacrament meeting. And then I was like, I'm out. I don't want to be here anymore. It's not a healthy place for me. And I need to get healthy and then I can come back when I'm healthy.
Were you sharing any of these concerns you had with anyone in particular, any leaders?
So actually that's a good question. So in the ward that I left that I had just come from, for about 6 months, or maybe even longer, there were a couple of visits that I had with our bishop where I told him, I am like having a really hard time. I'm really angry and I don't want to be angry. And I don't think God wants me to be angry. And I remember talking to him about that. And I remember him seeming understanding and being encouraging, but not really giving me anything to work with, besides like releasing me from, like I asked to be released from callings in one or two times. I think maybe that's because I was just like, I don't feel like I'm in a good place to serve. I don't feel like I have anything to give. Like, I'm just so angry. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I came across as angry, but I was feeling so betrayed and so mm-hmm. angry and confused at where my life was going. And so I had told him. And then I did, in that singles ward, I think I told that bishop that I was struggling. Again, I don't think he really helped too much. And I ended up hopping to a family ward after that and told that bishop that I was struggling. And he told me about how he was visited by his dead brother in the temple, like as if that should help me to like stay. And, you know, it's persuasive when people tell you stories about their spiritual experiences that seem like mind-blowing. And so, but still, like for the next 2 months, I've hopped to like 3 different wards, met with 3 different bishops, tried to get help, and none of them could give me something that would like make me feel better, if that makes sense. Sorry, I felt like that was really long.
No, but I think that they don't have the tools to give singles or homosexuals, which are in a similar, though different, yes, but similar circumstances.
Right.
They don't have the tools because there really aren't any tools that they can give. I mean, because I did go, so the last ward I attended was a family ward where the bishop was very concerned about the singles and he wanted to make sure that, you know, we all had callings, that we were connecting with each other. And I appreciated that. But it didn't change the fact that I was so physically and emotionally
isolated
that I was still depressed. And no amount of reading my scriptures or praying or going to the temple or serving others or, you know, increasing my friendships, no amount of any of that was working because the fundamental problem was I can't express sexuality. There's very little chance I will meet someone and get married.
So missing emotional intimacy.
I'm missing emotional intimacy. If I'm not married, I don't know what I am.
Well, and there's also this sense as a woman of not feeling empowered, right? I think, which is just to add to that list of feeling powerless to change the situation.
Yeah, because the rhetoric is it's just your trial. And when really, even a very loving bishop, what can he say beyond that? It's just your trial. I'm sorry you have to go through this. And then at night, he goes home and he has his wife and his kids. And it's not something he can really even relate to by experience. And so I never talked to a bishop about it because to me it was just like, they can't tell me anything that is going to help.
Well, and I guess I forgot to add too that when I did have like, you know, meetings to renew my temple recommend and meet with stake leaders or my ward leaders, almost every time they would be like, you're such a wonderful woman. You're such a beautiful woman. I don't understand why you're not married. Like, you should be married. Or, like, they kind of like, that was their message of comfort. Like, well, it makes no sense that you're single because you seem like you'd be a great partner. And then I'm thinking to myself, oh, so something really must be wrong with the men if, like, they're not seeing what all these priesthood leaders are seeing in me, these married priesthood leaders, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's just another way of, like, reinforcing, you know,
that gender divide.
That gender divide. Absolutely. Which, again, makes you angrier. It's just so unhealthy. But yeah, that's exactly how it is.
Jamie, you've mentioned your depression, also your anger. Do you want to talk about your breaking point?
Yeah. So for me, my breaking point was pretty gradual. It feels sudden, but it was pretty gradual. So like I said, when I was about 28, 29, I fell into a really deep depression. I mean, I was still going to work and was functioning, but that's all it was functioning. And I just saw that this was my life and I needed to find a way to accept it. And so that's what I was trying to do. I was just, you know, doing my best to accept it, but accepting it meant you know, like watching TV for hours to numb myself or reading books or basically any form of escapism. It meant feeling really numb and disconnected from myself and from others. And anyway, so it was when I was 29, I turned 29 and I kind of had a, I don't know why 29 was worse than 30, but really 30 was fine and 29 was just horrible. But I became so depressed that I started thinking that I needed help. I needed to go like see a therapist or something because I wasn't suicidal, but like I said, I just felt like I was waiting to die. And so I contacted a therapist that I wanted to see and he had a pretty extensive waiting list. And in the meantime, I decided I could take some steps to start remedying my situation myself. So I started reading a lot of psychological research, and I love the field of psychology anyway, so I just kind of got sucked into this, I don't know, vortex of psychology and research. And what I found was, like, there was a reason I was depressed. Like, intimacy is a fundamental human need. And most people who don't have it, single or married, are not very happy people because it is so vital to your well-being. And so all of a sudden, I started finding validation for what I was feeling, and I was not getting that validation at church. I was getting dismissed at church. This is just your trial. You just need to accept it. You just need to trust Christ and he will make this up to you.
You need to lose yourself in service.
You need to lose yourself in service. Exactly. And so what I was finding with the psychology articles I was reading, they were telling me the opposite thing. They were like, you know, if you're not having success in relationships, that's an issue that needs to be addressed. And during this time, I was also having some kind of philosophical problems with the church, or theological maybe. I really didn't like what happened with Prop 8. And I remember in my last year at BYU, which was a couple of years before Prop 8, someone in a study group that I was doing sent me a petition to like stop gay rights from, like, to stop that whole movement. And I refused to sign it because I could just, to me, there was just something that felt so fundamentally wrong about that. And so, you know, I was looking at these things and I was questioning church because of my lived experience, but also because things just weren't adding up for me. And so a breaking point that happened was probably about a year and a half ago. The second counselor in the bishopric got up and he bore his testimony and he talked about how much he really wanted some chocolate chip cookies one Sunday, but they didn't have the ingredients in his house. So he prayed. And guess what happened? There was a knock at the door right then, and somebody brought him chocolate chip cookies. And not only did that happen once, it happened three more times on different Sundays when he would pray, and then somebody would bring them chocolate chip cookies. And I remember sitting there thinking, you know, this was a ward that's downtown Salt Lake City, all walks of life. We had people who were chronically unemployed. We had people struggling with, like, debilitating health issues. We had single people. We had just every kind of difficulty. And I'm thinking, so God can bring this counselor chocolate chip cookies, but he cannot find that man a job.
Or
help me know what to do to, like, meet a good guy. He can't do those things. And it just didn't make sense to me. And I remember it wasn't long after that, really, that my belief system completely unraveled. And it still took me a few more months to finally make the final separation. But I still kind of consider that a pretty important point, that I just couldn't believe that. It just didn't make sense. It didn't feel right to me.
Yeah. I think part of why I felt angry for, like, my last couple of years of church was stories like those. And I remember, yeah, it didn't make sense. It didn't make sense. It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't, because it's not true. But, you know, people like to bring the bishopric treats. That's what I think it is. But, you know.
Plus, I'm envious of the counselor that his biggest problem was lack of chocolate chip cookies.
Right?
He has a blessed life.
But then I had to also wonder, and this is just kind of an aside, but I had to wonder, well, why did he keep praying for them instead of just, like, buying his own ingredients for chocolate chip cookies? Like, don't we teach self-reliance in the church? But, you know, that's just... But the other thing I want to mention is that, kind of with this theme that we've been going on of, we didn't see other options, that lack of empowerment. And so another really big moment for me was when I read Nicole Hardy's piece in the New York Times called Single Female Mormon Alone. And I read that and I wept, because she talks about leaving the church at 35 after not getting married, and she decides to claim her sexuality. And it's so beautifully written. It's just
everyone needs to read it.
I think everyone needs to read it to try and understand the single female experience in the church.
Do you want to address the sexuality needs of single women in the church?
Yes. So reading that piece, it was the first time I had ever even thought, well, I could leave the church. And so I printed it off my computer, and I would, like, reread it, and then I would say, no, I can't do that, and I'd, you know, put it somewhere else, and then I'd be feeling sad and lonely, and I'd pull it out again, and I'd read it, and I admired her, and she's since published her memoir, which I actually read during General Conference a year ago, because I decided I wasn't going to listen to conference, so I just read that on my phone instead, and by then, you know, I had already decided, like, I'm out. But yeah, and it really does tie in significantly with sexuality. Guess what? People don't want to be celibate. Newsflash.
And not only that, but it's, like, soul crushing to think that you're going to have to be for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Especially for women. Like, I know with men, it's, you know, early 20s are really hard years to...
Feeling that. A powerful sex drive.
Yeah. Then for women, it hits a little bit later. And so as I hit
It
is still powerful. But as I hit my late 20s, and I mean, I guess I'm 31 now, but I was almost, like, shocked at how strong the physical yearning for intimacy has been.
I remember always feeling like a sexual person. And I mean, in college, I remember I loved dancing. I'm not a great dancer, but I loved dancing, especially Latin dancing, and it made me feel really sexy. And I quit dancing at some point because I felt guilty, like for wanting to be sexy, for feeling sexy. Mm-hmm. And so I think for a lot of like my teens and early 20s, I felt this need to suppress that part of me, right? But as I got older, also when I was 28 or so, I remember finally being like, well, if God's going to expect me to be celibate for the rest of my life, then he better make some other concessions for me. Like, I'm going to watch some naughty movies and enjoy certain books, et cetera, uh-huh. et cetera.
Yes.
But I remember that was literally my thought process. Like, well, he can't expect me to be satisfied with nothing because there's that need.
It is a need. And I think the issue of female sexuality, I mean, you kind of touched on it a little bit. You stopped dancing because you felt guilty feeling sexy. Like, that's the message in the church to women. Like, you need to be pure. You need to be sweet and kind and service-oriented. But sexuality, that is not ever addressed. It's like, rein it in to the men, and women... It's invisible. It's right. Not even talked about.
Women have sexual needs? What?
And I mean, I'll quit bringing her up, but, that's another thing. I've listened to several interviews with Nicole Hardy, and I love how she talks about that. Like, people were so surprised when she'd tell them that she'd left the church, and she'd, you know, talk a little bit about why, and like, you have sexual needs? Like, wait a second, but you're not a man. Like, for the men, it's understandable if they leave the church because they're not married, because obviously they have to get some, but women feel that way? What is this?
Well, and I think, you know, with the church leaders who are predominantly male, right, and predominantly married, to get to a certain level, you have to be married at that, to get there. And what happens is there any allowance for men to be single in the church after a certain age? No. It's like, what are you doing? You need to get married. And I think part of that is because they understand that men have sexual needs as well as priesthood obligations or whatever. But I think also this message of, well, some women just have to be alone forever and like that's their lot. I think that the only way that they can continue to believe that that's okay is because of this ignorance of women's sexuality and their sexual needs. Because it is literally soul crushing. I mean, I keep repeating that, but that's how it felt for me to think, I'm not going to get any, mm-hmm. like ever, you know, or have emotional intimacy.
Oh yeah. I was devastated. Absolutely devastated. And especially because, I mean, I'm a literature major, so I've read many, 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 many books, and they all feature sex in some form or another. Like, sex is a really important experience in
for
life.
For humans, yeah.
It is. It just is. It's a way that you connect with your partner. And it can be fun. Like, it's pleasure. I mean, it's healthy, it can be unhealthy, I suppose, but...
Well, it's healthy to feel that need and that
But it's
drive.
Healthy to feel that need and, you
and
know,
to seek ways to fulfill it.
And again, like, it's unfortunate that in the church, you know, women's sexual needs are so ignored or that, you know, they're assumed that there aren't any. And also that it's such black and white thinking, like you're either a virgin or you're like a porn star and there is nothing in between. So like in exiting the church, I think, you know, I know for me, it's been interesting to think about sexuality and like try and figure out, well, okay, how do I feel about it now? Because I've been getting these messages my whole life. And what I'm finding is, guess what? There's a middle road. I can choose to be a sexually responsible human being and, you know, still have those needs met, but it doesn't mean that I'm becoming a whore.
Right. Yeah. Actually, you know, I left the church 5 years ago, and I do have to say that was really scary. I think that's also part of why it was so hard to get to a place where I could see that there were other options for my life. And part of that was because the world was this dark, scary place, and the men in the world were these horn dogs. You
know, like, they weren't going to respect you if you put it out. Women, yeah.
Objectify women.
Yeah.
And what I found was actually the reverse oftentimes. And it was interesting, in spite of that initial fear, how quickly I was able to kind of reorient myself in terms of what does a responsible sexual life look like for me? And it ended up feeling really natural for me. And I think part of that is because these needs and drives are natural. And also when you take away that framework.
I know in past conversations that we've had, you know, we've talked about this, and I've liked something that you said, Sarah, about, you know, we assign value to everything, really. And the church has assigned a certain value and message to sex. But does that reflect reality? Well, who really knows? Because you can assign all sorts of different meanings to different things. But, you know, that's been really helpful for me since I left a lot more recently than you. As I'm, you know, starting to navigate some of these decisions, I'm reminding myself, okay, this is what the church's, you know, assignment of value is to sexuality. Is that what I really feel is right? Or is that what I believe about it? And I'm finding that more often than not, no, I think that's antiquated. And so that was really helpful for me. I liked the way that you framed that.
Awesome. Well, someone else probably framed it that way for me. I mean, I took an anthropology course in the family unit. It was like families and sexuality or something. And I highly recommend it for anyone. If you can take an anthropology course in understanding families among humans, it totally broke down all of these, like, for me, it broke apart this idea of like chastity and virginity being a part of my value as a woman. And I was able to see where that came from in certain cultures, mm-hmm. and like blasted it away. And it didn't turn me into a whore. But it changed the value of certain, expressions of affection, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I know one way that I've been thinking about it is, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint, it made sense for sex to be reserved for marriage, you know, before birth control. But since birth control, I feel like those attitudes are kind of outdated. I mean...
Well, and especially where women's career roles have also changed.
Yes.
I mean, and I don't know that there's a cause and effect. These things have all kind of happened in similar time, like mm-hmm. at the similar time, but not only you have birth control and you also have women becoming legitimate contributors to like this Western economy where they're no longer dependent on men.
Yes.
For
absolutely.
For taking care of them. And I think those two things as like kind of go hand in hand in changing.
So naturally, they're going to change the way we think about
sexuality.
Sex.
Yeah.
And with that, women's sexuality has emerged. I mean, well, I guess it was always there, but like actually being able to talk about it and, you know,
acknowledge
and it, explore. And see it. Yeah. It's just, you know, the church is like
kind
couple
of
years.
In the 50s.
Yeah. Kind of. I was going to say a couple hundred years behind the times, but 50s is probably a little
bit
more.
Maybe the 60s by now.
So do you feel that the church's view on sexuality is just because they're behind the times, or do you also see it as a way of controlling their members?
Well, I honestly, I'm going to answer part of this, and then I think obviously both of us will, but I do think part of it is ignorance, because you have a bunch of men at the top. I just don't think that they ever are pressured to like really understand the female experience, and their wives, I don't think, tell them like about it. And so I want to say a lot of it is ignorance.
Yeah, I agree with that. I do think that there is some level of control. I think it's not just Mormonism, but most religions attempt to control people through sexuality. I don't know, it'd be interesting, you know, kind of a separate discussion for a different day, but it would be interesting to talk about like what some of those
what some of the results are. I mean, right. We've talked about sexual repression. If you're a minority, I mean, if you're homosexual or if you're single or whatever within the church framework, but I think there are also other challenges that creates. And one of the big ones is that you're teaching people that they are like wild animals,
mm-hmm. and they can't control themselves.
They can't control themselves and that they can't make responsible decisions, or that if they, cause let's be honest, unplanned pregnancies and STDs do happen, and sometimes with devastating consequences, but even then it's like, they're teaching that if those things happen, there's no recovery from that. And it's right. A loss of your worth and value, especially if you're female. So there are just some really damaging messages that surround the control.
Right. But yeah, I do think both of you are right. Well, I don't know what you think, but I think the control issue is real, and reinforcing the us versus them. And that's another way of doing that as well.
Mm-hmm. And it keeps people in the group too, because you're saying like, you have to wait until you get married. You need to get married in the temple. And, you know, so.
To one of the people who's in this group.
Because that's something else. I mean, this is becoming a really long podcast, but that's something else that I wanted us to talk about for just a minute, was like, well, what could the church do to improve the situation for singles? And I think it's honestly too bad that they would say it's better to be alone forever than to look outside your faith. Because there are so many great men and women of other faiths, or no faith as it may be, who would be good companions. And yeah, you're going to have to work some things out and make it, you know, it does present some unique challenges, but I know I have several friends in interfaith marriages who make it work and they're happy. And so it's too bad, I think, that the church is so focused on keeping like this closed group.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. And it's a great example of where the church is so putting its institutional needs above individual needs.
Yes.
Because there are plenty of women in the church, single women, who would have no problem finding a partner if there was any encouragement to look outside of the church, but the church would rather have them sacrifice their emotional and physical needs for the good of the church. And I just don't think the church leadership understands the costs on an individual level.
Well, they can't, because there is no single man at the top. There never will be.
Just the widowed ones.
There's Sherry Dew, but again, that's not even a really good example, but
yeah. Earlier you talked about Prop 8 and a little bit of how you felt like you could relate in some ways to kind of like the homosexual experience, in that both of us, as whether singles that are hetero or homosexual or whatever, are basically told the best thing for you is to be celibate. And I did want to say that that also was really important for my journey, my faith transition, that I had a really great friend who, a year before I left the church, came out of the closet and entered into a committed relationship with a boyfriend. And I remember initially being really sad and initially thinking, he seems like he's happy, but he can't really be happy. And then over the course of this, you know, 6 months to a year, being like, I think he's really happy. Like, here is my friend who had the courage to be called all of these things, terrible things, in this culture, in this church that he loved, and he leaves it and is shunned and criticized and called evil. And yet here he is, happy in this healthy relationship. And then it helped me to realize, and I'm not happy, and maybe I can be happy too. And I think it was really important for me to have kind of someone model this, like, I'm seeking something outside of what is supposed to be allowed for me, and I'm happy. And I ended up having courage eventually, thanks to people like him, to like be like, I can choose something outside of this church as well. Like, if I'm not going to find a partner in my faith community, I'm not content with that. Like, I'm going to look outside, because I think on an individual level, you know, that finding companionship is better than being alone.
Absolutely. And I just think it goes back to that idea of, you know, believing in a God who decides who gets what is a form of giving away your power. It really is. And, you know, I'm glad that we're talking about this, because I know that the rate of, you know, singles who are late 20s, early 30s is the attrition rate from the church is really high. And I just think, you know, we can't be the only ones who have had this experience. And in fact, I was reading a comment on a podcast that on a different Mormon forum, and it was a 28-year-old male who was talking about how he doesn't see that he can ever have a normal life because he has to pretend that he doesn't want to have intimate relations, and he doesn't see that he can ever have those. And I don't know what his situation is, but I just wanted to respond to him and say, but you can create the life that you want. You just have to be willing to look outside this framework. And it's hard, and it's scary, and your people aren't going to approve of you. But there is something to be said for, you know, like, nobody should have to choose between their religion and their sexuality.
I completely agree. I do really hope that the other people out there who may be scared to make that choice, I hope that they'll be able to have courage and know, like, there are so many great people in this world, men and women. And whatever your sexual orientation, or, you know, you can find a great partner if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. Any age.
I feel like we've talked for a long time, but I do want to say another thing that I really hate, that the church puts an expiration date on its single adults. Mm-hmm. Like, basically by kicking you out of certain congregations, for example, typical singles ward at 31, it's basically stamping you with expired, move on with your life. Join a family ward. And I think that causes a lot of anxiety for women and men who feel like they haven't expired yet.
Yeah.
And they still very much want to seek after intimacy and family.
Yeah.
And it's a completely arbitrary number. And I think that it's very hurtful of the church to kind of reinforce that there's an appropriate time to get married, and there's, you know,
and then when the window closes, it closes. When in reality, and, you know, in real life, you know, yeah, it is harder at maybe at certain points, certain ages, but there are always people getting divorced.
Yeah.
But when the pool is so much wider.
Yeah.
There's a lot more opportunity there. I mean, that's just how it goes. And you're more likely to attract someone when you feel like you can, like, and you don't get that as an older single in the church. I think a lot of people shut down.
Right. They think their chance is passed.
Yeah. Because of that arbitrary number that's, yeah, like your stamp of, well, you didn't make it. So yes, you just
get to be the cool single aunt or uncle.
Yeah. You can be a school teacher. And that's how you can work with children.
Or in the nursery.
Yeah, or primary. Yeah, like, yeah, that's a whole different conversation.
Do you want to talk a little bit about making that big jump into the unknown when you decided to leave church?
Sure. I'm like, I can always talk about everything. I have to say, when I made that leap, I was seeing a therapist, which was an enormous help. But I was hungry for stories of people like me who left the church as single adults. And I wanted to know that it worked out. And unfortunately, I didn't find a lot of those stories, but I did find a lot of stories of other people who left, as married couples or as one member of a married couple, and that life moved on for them. And that gave me courage, and my counselor, gave me courage. And, through therapy, I really felt like she helped me learn that I could seek after actively and proactively seek after the kind of life that I wanted. And I remember one of my first decisions with respect to dating was that I I was going to date on my own terms, and that meant I was not going to let men pay for me anymore. Mm-hmm. And I was going to do 50-50, like for first dates at least. And I remember feeling so excited about that. I like blogged about it, and that was my policy starting when, and then, you know, I hadn't dated very much for like my 10 years of dating life as a Mormon. But once I left and I felt empowered and I started to really like myself, dating was like, it was easier than I expected. Like I met people initially through like the ex-Mormon community online. And, ultimately I met my husband on an online dating site. And I don't think I'm really answering the question anymore. But like, I do remember like, once I felt like I liked myself and I could pay for myself, I didn't have to like be anyone else's prize. It opened things up.
You had no limitations.
Yeah.
What about you, Jamie? Tell us about your big old jump.
So my jump has been a lot more recent than Sarah's. So I'm like in that transition right now of just figuring out what I want, but I've also been in therapy for the past year, and that's been like amazingly helpful for me. Because I'm also just, you know, like, hey, I like myself and I can make a lot of contributions and, you know, use my talents and skills to like build my community around me. And so I'm really excited about that. And interestingly, I left the church because of being single and feeling that isolation and that, you know, disconnection. But since leaving, I'm not worried about my marital status anymore. And I think part of the reason is that I'm not going to a place where like it's reinforced that I'm a failure because I didn't get married. Instead, I'm like so excited I'm just so excited about life, and like I want to apply to clinical psychology PhD programs, and so I'm planning that, and I, you know, have been dating a little bit, and that's been fun to just do it. I'm not serious about anyone right now, but I'm just so excited about like creating the life that I want. And again, not being passive, because this is what God wants for me. Like I'm choosing what I want for me and then seeking after it. And it's been like an amazing experience.
Well, and I love that you brought that up, Jamie, because I do want to say that like, yeah, once I got to that place where I was ready to make that jump, all of a sudden being single wasn't a terrible thing. It was like an exciting thing.
Yeah.
And it was exciting, like, cause it opened up new dating opportunities. It was exciting because now I could really think about what kind of a career I wanted and I could pursue it because I was single. And so like, yeah. I had no limitations. And I mean, here I am 5 years later and my life still feels like a dream. Like it just feels like I can't believe that I get to pursue the career that I want, that I get to have a relationship with the kind of person that I want, that I get to approach parenting in the way that makes the most sense to me and my partner. No one else dictates any of these things anymore. And it's this huge sense of relief and empowerment, and like the world is open to me. And I can't stop gushing about how different it is from where I was even 3 months before, like leaving the church, where I felt like, this is my life. It sucks. God's testing me. I'll be alone forever. Mm-hmm. And I'll never feel motivated about my job because even, like, I couldn't even have a vision for like having a satisfying career because it was like not what I really wanted, which was marriage and family at the time. Now I can have both.
Yeah. Yep. Amen to that.
Well, I appreciate hearing the perspective of the single woman, because I haven't really been that in the church, but there are a lot of things I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, that would be a problem and that doesn't work. And people deserve better than that. And they don't deserve boundaries. People should have their own limitations. Also, we've talked several times about therapy. And one thing that excites me about Mormon Expression is that they are working with therapists now. So I encourage anyone that feels they need help, that they can go to Whitefields Educational and find help if they would like it.
Counseling is a treat.
And if there are any women in the church that are feeling the same way as Jamie and Sarah, you can reach them through me. Go ahead and email me at voices@mormonexpression.com, and I can forward your messages to Jamie and Sarah. And also, if you'd like to be on Mormon Expression Voices, I'm always looking for somebody willing to share their story. So email me for that as well. Well, thank you very much, Jamie and Sarah. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thanks.